Time now for Connor's Corner, where Mike takes a closer look at topics like history, politics, religion, and more. Here's Mike.
Welcome to the Connor's Corner segment of Ask the Lawyer. Right now, up next, we have an old friend of the show. In fact, Pat Novakovsky, I saw him, what was it, last month or so, we saw you down in Washington at the St. John Paul Center.
Yes, that was in preparation for the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast.
Right, right. Now, where do you live, Pat?
I live in Northern Virginia.
Okay, so I think you guys had an election last week?
We did. Very exciting election with some very good results.
Okay, now, as a Catholic, why would you say it's good results?
Well, I'm a pro-life Catholic. My full-time job is running a pregnancy center, crisis pregnancy center in Northern Virginia. And I'm also a Catholic author and writer and I guess you could say a pro-life activist. So, you know, for me, the ultimate test of a leader, politician or otherwise, is something that John Paul II said. He said that America's greatness is only measured by how it treats the most vulnerable, particularly the unborn in the womb. So I really look at that in a politician. And if he gets that part right, then I'm interested in hearing what he has to say about everything else. Because like anyone else in the culture, if you treat the vulnerable with dignity and respect, then you earn my respect, no matter if that's an unborn person, a disabled person, an elderly person in the nursing home. If you treat them with respect, then I expect that you're going to get most of the other stuff right or get pretty close. So the three folks that we've elected here, our lieutenant governor, our governor, and, being an immigrant from Canada, I don't always look at the titles. anyway, we've elected three pro-lifers to statewide office in the state of Virginia, and that makes me happy.
Well, that's really quite a turnaround since you're considering your last governor.
Yes,
or your present absolutely. Governor still.
Yeah. I mean, Ralph Northam said that if a baby is born after an abortion, survives the abortion, well, let's just put him on a table and keep him comfortable until he dies. That's quite a different sentiment, treating the vulnerable, than someone who says, yes, we need to uphold the dignity of the child in the womb and save them and their mother from the violence of abortion. So Governor-elect Youngkin has my support. He has my ear. And not only that, but the House of Delegates in Virginia is also filled with pro-lifers, and the Republicans have taken over the House of Delegates. So it's an exciting time. I don't know if Virginia is going to follow Texas and Mississippi and Florida in becoming a red state. We'll see. And again, you know, Youngkin is a brand new politician like Donald Trump. He had never held office before. He's a businessman. So we'll see what kind of policies he puts forward and where he goes with this, because campaigning is one thing, but governing is quite another.
Yeah. Now, you know, we're talking about, St. John Paul, and you wrote a book about John Paul. Can you explain to the audience what the book is, and can we still get it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me give you some background. I worked for a religious order, a Polish priests and brothers, for 5 years in the late 90s, early 2000s. And in that experience, in writing for them, they sent me to Rome every year, and I had the chance to meet John Paul II 5 times between 1997 and 2002. So he died in 2005, and, you know, I was thinking about my experiences with him and what is God saying I should do with that, because I'm a farm kid from Saskatchewan, Canada. How does that happen that I get to meet this great Pope 5 times and actually have conversations with him? So we were coming up on his 100th birthday in May of 2020, and it struck me that I'd already been giving talks about this all across the country, talking about his legacy and the great things that he did. So I decided to put that into a book, and I called it 100 Ways John Paul II Changed the World. And yes, it's still available. It's really kind of a primer on John Paul II. If you really want to understand him in a very easy read, that's really how I put it together. Each of those 100 ways is only a page, page and a half. So it's a really condensed biography that kind of gives you a snapshot of his influence, not only on the Catholic Church, but on the world for 26 and a half years. And yes, it's available. People can get it on Amazon. It was published by Our Sunday Visitor, so you can get it on their website, or you can buy an autographed copy from me, and that website is real easy, booksbypatrick.com.
Booksbypatrick.com.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't think even I can screw that one up. You never know. I'm not the best guy on the computer and typing stuff in, but I think I could make that one. But give us an example. I mean, I think, you know, as history moves on, I don't think people realize how the world was so much different when John Paul took the office of the papacy as opposed to now. I mean, we had communism. You know, of course, we have communism in New York, but that's a little different.
Yeah, John Paul II grew up in a free Poland. He was 18 years old. He moved to Krakow. He started college. And a year later, the Nazis moved in and rolled their tanks over the whole country. And his education was put to a very quick halt. In that time, he wanted to be an actor. And then his father died, and the Nazis took over. And he started thinking more about God, and he left acting to become a priest. Now, at the time he joined the seminary, the Nazis were rounding up seminarians and shooting them in the head. So he literally risked his life as a young man to become a seminarian, to become a priest. By the time he was ordained, the Nazis had been eliminated, and the West kind of said, oh, Soviet Union, here, you take over Poland. And so he lived under this oppressive communist regime his entire priesthood. He became bishop, auxiliary bishop of Krakow, then archbishop of Krakow, and then in 1978, still communist in Poland, he became the Pope. He came back to Poland a year after he was elected and essentially did a tour of the whole country. Millions of people saw him, and he called down the Holy Spirit on the land and rallied the people to live their faith, to live like free people. And that was something that the communist government could not stop. 10 years later, the Berlin Wall fell, because Reagan teamed up with John Paul II. And matter of fact, in 79, when John Paul went back to Poland for the first time as Pope, Reagan was at his ranch in California watching this on TV. And as most of your listeners will know, who grew up in the 60s and 70s, Reagan was one of the most ardent advocates against communism in the United States, all through his governorship of California, and of course into his presidency. But Reagan was campaigning for president. He saw John Paul II in Poland, and he said the Pope is the key. He is the key to ending communism in Eastern Europe, and he was right. So one of the first things Reagan did as president was appoint the very first ambassador to the Holy See, and then teamed up with John Paul II, and they collaborated. They shared intelligence. A lot of it's still classified. And one thing led to another, and we have freedom in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, and you know, like, I remember once, you know, reading an article, you know, just after the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union started to collapse, and there was an article of how people derided Reagan for his naivete about the end of communism. You know, that it could happen. They were taking quotes from him in the 80s, and you know, that'll be on the ash heap of history. And of course, he was right, and all the intellectuals were totally wrong at that time.
Oh yeah, and we all know the speech that he gave at the Brandenburg Gate, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And the silly thing is that everybody on Reagan's staff said, "Oh, Mr. President, you can't say that." And he says, well, I'm going to say it. They took it out of the speech. He put it back in the speech. They took it out again. He put it back in again. He said it, and he was right.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. I served 3 years in Germany. And if you told me at one point that that wall was coming down, I would say you're crazy. It's going to stay up for our lifetimes.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up in Canada, and I always thought that when this nuclear war started, Russia was going to send its missiles over the North Pole, and America was going to send theirs back, and they would land right on my head in Canada. That was my greatest fear, because, I mean, everybody thought that's how it was going to end, right?
Right.
And then came Gorbachev, who was secretly baptized when he was a baby, and they didn't tell us that. So he was baptized as a child. He never would have been the leader of the Soviet Union or even in the Politburo had they known he was baptized, but he was.
Now, if I may.
All in God's great providence.
If I may, having gone to McGill, you know, you being Canadian, I mean, the culture conflict there, we underestimate the differences between us and Canada sometimes. And, I mean, you know, how are Canadian Catholics dealing with Justin Trudeau?
Well, it depends how you measure their Catholicism, honestly. I mean, if you're a fervent Catholic, a Sunday church-going Catholic who understands the faith, you're very frustrated by Mr. Trudeau, as we were back in the 70s by his father. So I know. And here's the thing where Canada and the United States actually have some similarities. There are four countries in the world that have no restrictions on abortions: North Korea, China, Canada, and the United States. How is that even possible that two of the most civilized countries and two of the most communist countries have the same policy on abortion? Every European country has restrictions on abortion. We don't. So how civilized are we really? And I think a lot of the problems in the culture, it stem from this.
Even
whole
our dog is growling
abortion.
At that.
Yeah. Well, you can't kill a dog, but you can kill an unborn baby. You can't break the turtle's eggs on the beach, but or the eagle's nest full of eagle's eggs, but the baby in the womb is open. It's open season. I mean, it's ridiculous if you think about it. And there are consequences to this. You know, if we cheapen life and say it's expendable at one stage of development, the unborn, then who's to say that any other stage can't arbitrarily be chosen as expendable as well?
Or the elderly who are no longer useful to society. I mean, remember, we're broadcasting from a trust and estates firm. So...
Of course. You know, you put the COVID patients into the nursing home, and of course you reduce the population of the nursing home, and it eases the burden, the financial burden on the state, right?
Yeah, I don't want to be that cynical, but that did occur to me. You know, most of the people in the nursing homes, their bills are paid by Medicaid after a while, and so at the rate of $12,000-$13,000 a month for each person that died, the state doesn't have to pay for that. Now, I really did not want to be that cynical, but it did cross my mind.
Oh, it's crossed the minds of everyone who's observed what's gone on, and it's not just in New York. It's in other states where it's open season on the unborn, you know. And our Catholic president wants to codify Roe v. Wade in law, and that will nullify all of the state laws that have been enacted to protect the unborn. So if that happens, then whether Roe v. Wade is overturned at the Supreme Court, it's a moot point because it will have been codified. So this year, leading up to next June, when the Supreme Court will decide on the Mississippi law that protects the unborn, they're also debating the Texas law. It's going to be a fundamental decision that will either shift or put a dark line on where we are, where we stand as a nation when it comes to protecting the unborn from the violence of abortion.
Yeah, and you bring up a very good point. I mean, if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, it goes back to the states. And what
Absolutely.
This Congress is trying to do, well, no, the states, you don't have any control. We're going to legislate for you through the Congress. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not going to pass right now, but you never know what's going to happen in the future.
Well, they did this with marriage, right? I mean, it was up to each state. A lot of states passed constitutional amendments protecting marriage as between one man and one woman. Then the Supreme Court ruled that it's open season for marriage. You can marry whoever you want. And really kind of threw out the state's rights on marriage. So they can do the same on abortion. It's the same on virtually anything, overriding the states. And I really don't know that that's what the framers intended.
All right. Well, we're running out of time, but Pat, one last thing. What book are you working on now, and when do we expect to see it out?
Well, I'm a big fan of Pope Benedict the 16th. So my sequel, I've got an outline. I don't expect it to be out for another year, but it will be called 100 Ways Pope Benedict the 16th Changed the World.
Now, I mean, I think most people at first glance, they would agree with you that John Paul changed the world. How did Benedict change the world? If you can give us an example.
Well, honestly, John Paul II would not have been as successful as he was without Benedict at his side. They met at the conclave that elected John Paul I in 1978, when John Paul II was elected 3 months later, and we had three popes in 1 year in 1978. He asked Cardinal Ratzinger to join him at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and to lead that. He had been the newly elected Archbishop of Munich, and he said, I'm kind of new at this, kind of, you know, give me some time. So in 1982, we're coming up on 40 years since Benedict went to the Vatican, and he actually did. So about 4 or 5 years later, he acquiesced and he said, okay, Holy Father, I'll come. He came to the Vatican. He worked for John Paul II. Benedict is a theologian. John Paul II was a philosopher. They're like two halves of a great brain, right? That really powered the intellectual and even the word I'm looking for. It's not political, but the work that John Paul II did. It was really the two of them together collaborating. They met every week, every Friday. They met and talked for hours. And I really think that collaboration was essential to John Paul II changing the world as he did. But Benedict also on his own, he set up the Anglican Ordinariate. So there are a lot of Anglicans that were leaving the Anglican Church, converting to Catholicism. He kind of just made it a little bit easier and allowed them to have their own rite, their own way to convert, and their own bishop in the Catholic Church. So that was really fundamental in his papacy. He wrote this beautiful series on Jesus called the Jesus of Nazareth series, three books, reflections on the life of Jesus, and really profound works.
Are you going to involve the speech at Regensburg at all?
Oh, of course. I think that was kind of a hinge point. He kind of made mention of in Regensburg about halfway through his papacy of Islam, and it really ignited a firestorm around Islam and Catholicism. And I have not delved into that too much, so I can't really speak to it very much. But yes, of course, that was kind of a touchstone of his papacy as well.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things is that in each generation we have a different enemy to tackle. And for John Paul, it was atheism. It was the Soviet Union. And so for him, going against Islam was not necessarily something that he wanted to, you know, it wasn't a battle he wanted to fight. But for Benedict, he saw the coming enemy, so to speak.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily think he saw Islam as an enemy, more as we need to see Islam for what it is, for what it truly is. I really think that when he talked about the dictatorship of relativism, the fact that relativism was becoming a current in the culture that we needed to be aware of and we needed to kind of put a halt to, where, you know, the idea that you have your truth, I have my truth, but there is no absolute truth to anything.
I mean, of course that's BS.
That thinking is just
wrong.
You know,
it's complete BS.
Of course it is. Yeah, but that's the way some people think these days. And so I think that will, in my book, will rank very high, his confronting the dictatorship of relativism and building on the work that John Paul II worked on. I mean, he also was very strong on divine mercy. You know, John Paul II opened St. Faustina's cause for canonization. He saw her diary, had it translated, had it authenticated, and then proclaimed Divine Mercy Sunday, the Sunday after Easter. Catholics will know what I'm talking about in your audience. And then Pope Benedict kind of continued that tradition. He also continued John Paul's tradition of World Youth Day that Pope Francis has picked up on. So there are a lot of things that John Paul II laid out and that Benedict and Francis have continued and even accelerated.
Pat, just in closing right now, can you repeat your website again and what's on your website?
Yeah, so I'm also a public speaker. I do a lot of public speaking, and my book is for sale on my website. So a little bit more about me, just go to booksbypatrick.com.
Booksbypatrick.com. Patrick, thank you very much for being on Connor's Corner. We hope to see you soon.